Section 4, North Carolina from Confederation to Constitution. As you read, look for why the state of Franklin was founded and why it failed. Weaknesses in the Articles of Confederation that led to calls for a new government. Debates and compromises that created the U.S. Constitution. Conflicting views of Federalists and Anti-Federalists. Results of the Hillsborough and Fayetteville Conventions, and the following terms: Articles of Confederation, Compromise, Federalists, and Anti-Federalists. North Carolina only slowly recovered from the hate and destruction left over from the War for Independence. The state was so disorganized that the General Assembly moved from place to place after the war. Some host towns like Tarboro and Smithfield or the hamlet around Wake Courthouse had fewer houses than there were legislators. There was even less money for the state to spend than there were places to meet. The paper money issued to pay for military expenses was worthless, and state residents did not want to accept it. Trade suffered at ports like Ocracoke. New towns like Kinston on the Neuse River were slow to grow. To raise money, the state continued to sell the confiscated lands of Tories, even though the Treaty of Paris of 1783 said that was illegal. The state also could not make up its mind whether to give its lands west of the Appalachians to the Confederation. In 1784, the state decided to give up those lands. Then it reversed that decision when it thought it could raise the money from their sale. Some North Carolinians also wanted to get rich by being the agents for the sales. As William Hooper, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, observed, what some North Carolinians called political zeal was really avarice clothed in the cover of patriotism. The State of Franklin. While North Carolinians in the East argued over Tory rights, residents west of the Blue Ridge wanted more control over their own rights. Most of those settlers lived on the tributaries of the Tennessee River, like the Holston or the Watauga. Some had moved to this fertile but remote area to escape regulation. Others were veterans of the War of Independence, who went west to claim lands the state owed them for their military service. They did not particularly like the leaders from the coastal plain who had beaten them at Alamance and deserted them after Camden. One eastern legislator returned the scorn. The Watauga settlers, he claimed, were the offscourings of the earth. When North Carolina's General Assembly in 1784 ceded its western lands to the Confederation government, the leaders of the Watauga area immediately petitioned Congress to set up a new state. They wanted to name the state Franklin, after Benjamin Franklin of Philadelphia. When North Carolina took back the land, the organizers of the state of Franklin went ahead anyway. In 1784, they met at Jonesboro, wrote a constitution, and elected John Sevier, one of the commanders of the Over Mountain Men, as their governor. Like most other events in North Carolina history, the state of Franklin was controversial. Both the Confederation Congress and the North Carolina General Assembly refused to recognize the new state. Soon, Franklin's residents began to fight among themselves. Some people were actually killed over the issue. Split from within and scorned elsewhere, the state of Franklin ceased to exist by 1787. The fight over Franklin, however, did help create the state of Tennessee. The long distance to the mountains made it impractical for North Carolina to provide a fair government. After North Carolina joined the new United States in 1789, the lands were once again ceded. The territory of Tennessee was set up in 1794, and statehood was granted in 1796. North Carolina under the Articles of Confederation. During the War for Independence, the Continental Congress adopted the country's first constitution, called the Articles of Confederation. The Articles created a one-house national legislature, Congress, in which each state had one vote. There was a president, but he had hardly any power, and there was no court system. The Confederation, as that government was called, provided for national defense and foreign policy during those years. Foreign policy refers to a nation's international relations. The Confederation Congress did succeed in signing a peace treaty with the British and securing new lands west of the Appalachian Mountains. However, the Confederation was most often ineffective because it lacked money and resources. Its difficulties were much the same as those of North Carolina, but on a larger scale. Americans generally suffered during the period because the British refused to abide by some of the terms of the 1783 peace treaty. In 1784, the British closed off trade to its Caribbean islands. This trade had provided North Carolinians with more than half of their income. The British also refused to leave the military bases they had built west of the Appalachians. From forts like Detroit, the British encouraged the Indians to attack white settlers who were moving into the valleys of the Kentucky and Tennessee rivers. More than once, the Watauga settlers, led by John Sevier, fought off Cherokee attacks. The new United States seemed shaky on many fronts in 1786 and 1787. North Carolinians were fighting each other in Franklin. Massachusetts mobs were marching on their courthouses to keep farmers from having their property seized for unpaid debts, just as the regulators had done in North Carolina years before. These rebellions convinced many American leaders that a stronger government was needed in every state. North Carolina and the Federal Constitution. Since the Confederation Congress lacked the resources and power to do much, prominent citizens took action to protect their lives and investments. In Virginia, George Washington was having problems selling the crops grown at his home at Mount Vernon. He called for the leaders of nearby states to meet and discuss new ways to improve trade and government. This led to a meeting in Annapolis, Maryland in 1786 that called for the reform of the Confederation. North Carolina appointed delegates, but no one attended the meeting. The Annapolis group then put out an invitation to every state to come to Philadelphia in 1787 to decide what to do. All 13 states sent representatives to the Philadelphia Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787. Soon, most delegates had agreed that the articles could not be fixed and a new government was needed. They began to write a constitution to organize it. North Carolinians played a small but significant role in achieving the compromises, agreements where each side gives up something and gets something at once, that led to the acceptance of the United States Constitution. The Virginians, led by James Madison, proposed a more powerful national government that would oversee most activities of citizens and states. This plan called for a Congress with two houses. Representation in each house would be based upon population. Thus, North Carolina, which was the fifth most populous state at the time, would benefit by having more votes. The small states, like Connecticut, objected because they would lose power under that plan. They countered with a plan that gave each state an equal vote on every issue, regardless of its size. When it became apparent that the two sides could not agree, the leaders of the convention came up with its first important compromise. The Great Compromise, as it was called, set up the government Americans have today, which we learned about in Chapter 3. In the House of Representatives, members are elected every 2 years. The number of representatives a state has is based on its population. That way, states with a lot of people get more representatives. The Senate, in turn, consists of two members from each state, giving each state an equal role in that branch of the legislature. Senators were given 6-year terms of office. Only a third would be elected at one time. This meant that elections could be held every 2 years for Congress, but someone with experience would still be in office, even if all the representatives and senators up for re-election lost. North Carolina's William R. Davy, a Halifax lawyer, served on the Grand Committee that came up with the Great Compromise. He had pushed the idea of an equal number of senators for each state because, as he said, we are partly federal, partly national in our union. In fact, Davy was said to have cast the most decisive single vote in the convention to make the compromise succeed. Once a balanced scheme for representation was agreed to, most of the rest of the government was logically thought out. For example, the chief executive, called the president, could veto laws passed by Congress. However, Congress could override the veto by a two-thirds majority of each house. The president was to serve a four-year term as a balance between the terms of the two houses in Congress. North Carolina's Hugh Williamson, an Edenton physician, was instrumental in getting the other delegates to adopt the two-thirds ratio for overturning vetoes. One final dispute almost kept the convention from completing its task and led to the second of the major compromises. The delegates from the northern states disagreed strongly with the desire of the southern delegates to count slaves as people being represented in the government. Because slaves were property as well as persons, the northern delegates whose states had few slaves wanted them left out. This would give their states a numerical advantage in the new Congress. Southerners wanted them counted, which would give them the advantage. After much argument and debate, the delegates agreed to their second significant compromise. They split the difference somewhat. Slaves were to be counted as 3/5 of a person when it came to representation. North Carolinians went along with their fellow Southern delegates in demanding this. Ever since, this has been known as the 3/5 compromise. North Carolina's Hugh Williams had been one of the first to suggest that proportion as appropriate. North Carolina hesitates to ratify. The writers of the Constitution decided to ask the people in the various states to ratify, approve, the new form of government. Before the end of 1787, several states had ratified the document. By 1788, enough states had joined the Union that the United States held its first elections and chose George Washington as president. North Carolina was not among them. Although leaders like William R. Davy and Hugh Williamson assured people that the U.S. Constitution was superior to the Confederation, many residents distrusted the plan. The state was divided between Federalists, those in favor of the new government, and Anti-Federalists, those who distrusted its ideas. Most of the Federalists lived along the coast. They included, for example, James Iredell of Edenton, who urged that local interests give way to the general good. Federalists stood to benefit from the new powers over business and money that the new government would have. For example, coins were to have the same value anywhere in the nation. North Carolina, the Federalists said, would be better organized and protected to make more money in overseas trade. Anti-Federalists often came from the backcountry. They included the Reverend David Caldwell of Guilford County, the state's most respected educator. They worried about how powerful the new government would become, remembering how Governor Tryon had taken advantage of them before the Revolution. One Anti-Federalist feared that the Federalists would act just like the British had, sending out armies and crushing the liberties of the people. People across North Carolina debated the merits of the Constitution. Sometimes they were louder than they were logical. One Federalist called the opposition a set of fools and knaves. An Anti-Federalist declared that even George Washington was a rascal and traitor for being a Federalist. Because so many people in the backcountry had suffered in the Regulation and the Revolution, and because they were the majority, the Anti-Federalists were able to stop the first attempt to ratify the Constitution. The Hillsborough Convention. The delegates met in July 1788 at Hillsborough. They voted overwhelmingly, 184-83, to delay ratifying the Constitution. The majority believed the new government would become too powerful. Since the new government was about to be put into effect anyway, the delegates did agree that they would accept the Union if some changes were put into the Constitution. The Anti-Federalists particularly wanted a Bill of Rights, believing that such amendments would protect their basic rights. The members of the Hillsborough Convention proposed more than 20 amendments to safeguard the great principles of civil and religious liberty that were unalienable rights of the people. North Carolinians were gambling with their future by refusing to join the rest of the United States. Their state would be surrounded by the new nation and denied its promised benefits, like real money and reliable markets. Rhode Island had been the only other state to turn down the Constitution. Since Rhode Island and North Carolina had poor records managing their money, business leaders expected to pay high prices to trade with the new country. To encourage North Carolina to join the Union, Congress delayed any special taxes on North Carolina goods until 1790. In addition, James Madison, the leader of the new Congress, worked to have a Bill of Rights approved by the other states. Both the friendliness of the new Union and the disadvantages of not joining became apparent to many North Carolinians. The Fayetteville Convention. In November 1788, the North Carolina legislature called for a second vote on the Constitution. A year later, in November 1789, another convention met in Fayetteville. This time, the vote was an overwhelmingly for the Union, as the previous vote in Hillsborough had been against it. The vote was 194 to 77. Only a few counties full of former regulators continued to oppose ratification. Growing national support for a Bill of Rights pleased supporters of ratification. North Carolina sent its first representatives and senators to the new government in 1790. They were mostly Federalists. The representatives included John Steele of Salisbury, Hugh Williamson of Edenton, and John Sevier of Jonesboro. Sevier's election showed just how up and down state politics could be. He had been the governor of the rebel state of Franklin, but the voters in the state had long forgiven him, as they had many of the people who had hated and resented and fought one another for so long in the struggle to create the state. The state establishes a new capital. North Carolina made a major effort to get organized and move forward during the debate over the Constitution. The 1788 Hillsborough Convention had agreed to a site for a permanent state capital. The convention chose an area in Wake County within 10 miles of Isaac Hunter's Tavern. They chose Raleigh as the capital's name. The site was just about equal distance for people in the backcountry, the Cape Fear, and the Albemarle to travel. After a commission found a location at the Joel Lane Plantation, the legislature moved to Raleigh in 1794. Not everyone accepted the Raleigh location. The newly created town of Fayetteville made a real effort to gain the capital. Fayetteville was the result of two colonial towns, Cross Creek and Campbelltown, growing together on the Cape Fear River. The town was named for the Marquis de Lafayette, a Revolutionary War general. Even after the 1788 decision, Fayetteville built a new state house to host the 1789 convention, hoping for a reversal. It did not get the right number of votes, and Raleigh's streets were soon laid out. The new capital grew very slowly, however. One early visitor said that every street ended in the woods. The first state university. The legislature that met in Fayetteville in 1789 also established a state university. William R. Davy, who led the effort, later chose a location for the school south of Hillsborough, near the New Hope Chapel of Governor Tryon's day. Soon after the university was opened in 1795, school officials also established the village of Chapel Hill. Although the trustees of the college tried their best to make the university a symbol of a united state, the sectional divisions continued in some ways. Students from the eastern section tended to join one debating society, and those from the west another one. These tendencies would continue to cause trouble for North Carolina into the early part of the next century. Special feature, Carolina People, William R. Davy. Patriot, planner, educator, compromiser, innovator. These are five of the many words that describe William Richardson Davy. This revolutionary leader also deserves to be described as a founding father. Davy, born in England, eventually moved with his Scottish parents to the Waxhaws, a Scots-Irish neighborhood on the North Carolina-South Carolina border southeast of Charlotte. He was too young to take part in the regulation, but he was one of the first to enroll at Queen's Academy. He advanced so rapidly in his studies that he soon was admitted to the College of New Jersey, today's Princeton University. Davy was so eager to be a patriot in 1775 that he went off with fellow students to fight with George Washington, risking suspension. He never did graduate, but moved to Salisbury to study law. Again, he excelled, and when he became a lawyer at age 23, his first client was Governor Richard Caswell. When the British invaded the Carolinas in 1779, Davy became a captain of mounted partisans, volunteers who had both a sword and a rifle and could fight either on horseback or on foot. Davy became a hero when he almost kept the British from capturing Charlotte in September 1780. When the British invaded the Carolinas in 1779, Davy became a captain of mounted partisans, volunteers who had both a sword and a rifle and could fight either on horseback or on foot. Davy became a hero when he almost kept the British from capturing Charlotte in September 1780. So versatile was he that the state made him the commissary general. This duty required him to find food for the soldiers and fodder for the horses during the terrible winter of 1781. After the war, he moved to Halifax. He was elected to the state legislature and at age 31 was a participant in the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, where he was said to have often been silent in open debate, but his opinion was always valued. He helped decide that each state should be equally represented in the Senate, and he got other North Carolinians to agree to the Great Compromise. One North Carolinian later said Davy's vote was critical in saving the Constitution itself. He did not stay long enough to sign the new Constitution, but he voted for it at both the Hillsborough and Fayetteville conventions. He later became governor. Davy is remembered today as the principal founder of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Legend has it he had a picnic under a poplar tree near the old chapel built during the time of William Tryon. He had such a pleasant time that he chose that site. Most historians now doubt the picnic happened, but the university long has honored the Davy Poplar as the site of its origin. The tree, now more than 300 years old, has concrete in its hollow trunk and is held up by guy wires going to nearby oaks. Nearby Davy Jr. and Davy III are well-tended reminders of Davy's legacy.